You are listening to WSLR 96.5 FM Sarasota in conjunction with 100.1 in Bradenton, and that is BPV Low Power Radio.
Good morning. This is the Florida Caribe Show. I'm your host, Paola Baez.
And this is Jerina Georgie. So, welcome to Florida Caribe. That was a song by Marta Gomez, La Ronda. We have a great show for you today with some great music, current events from Latin America, an interview from Proyecto Carito, an NGO from Emerson College in Boston. Let's start off the show with some music, making a connection between Latin America and Europe, our favorite part of our show. Now, Ana Tujo is a Latin American hip-hop artist that lived in political exile with her parents in France during the times of Pinochet. She uses Chilean rap and hip-hop to talk about the violence and inequalities that is facing Latin America today. The song is called Sacar La Voz, featuring Jorge Drexler. I hope you enjoy the song.
We'll also be talking about very important issues dealing with the Pope, Mexico, and indigenous people coming up. Stay tuned, everybody. Here we go for Ana Tujo, a Latin American hip-hop artist. It's very important to the American story. Here we go.
Enjoy.
It's running. I don't know what the whole
si lo creamos los dos, liberarse de todo el pudor, tomar de las riendas, no rendirse al opresor, caminar erguido sin temor, respirar y sacar la voz. Tengo los bolsillos vacíos, los labios partidos, la piel con escama cada vez que miro hacia el vacío, las suelas gastadas, las manos atadas, la puerta de entrada siempre tuvo el cartel que dijo que estaba cerrada, una espina clavada, una herida infectada, entramada, una rabia colmada, en el todo y en la nada, el paso torpe al borde sin acorde, cada vez que pierdo el norte, tengo la pérdida del soporte, el tiempo que clava, me traba, la daga me mata, filuda la flama sin calma, que de las manos se me escapa, pero tengo mi rincón florido, sacar la voz, no estoy sola, estoy conmigo. Liberarse de todo el pudor, tomar de las riendas, no rendirse al opresor, caminar erguido sin temor, respirar y sacar la voz. Estaban quebrados, el mirar encorvado, el puño cerrado. No tengo nada, pero nada suma en este charco. Mandíbula marcada, palabra preparada, cada letra afilada hasta la cresta de la oleada. Sin pena ni gloria, escribir esta historia. El tema no es caerse, levantarse es la victoria. Venir de vuelta, abrir la puerta, estar resuelta, estar alerta. Sacar la voz que estaba muerta y hacer la orquesta. Caminar, seguro, libre, sin temor, respirar. La voz. Liberarse de todo el pudor, tomar de las riendas, no rendirse al opresor, caminar erguido sin temor, respirar y sacar la voz.
Haga lo que haga uno, estraga oportuno, tú no cobras lo que el tiempo paga, se traga saga tras saga, raspa con su amarga espátula, huérfano se hace de brújula, su lúcida lenta en celo, blanca el arma, blanco el pelo, su blanca cara de crápula, esta décima espinela, la que Violeta cantaba, la de la sílaba octava del payador, vieja escuela, y lo que duela, si es que tiene que doler, la flama sin calma que arder tenga, que así siga ardiendo, que siga fosforeciendo si tiene que florecer.
A colgar la copla que el viento mece, que pocas veces merece, cada pena en su altavoz, cada tos, pensando en sacar la voz.
So welcome back to Florida Caribe. That was Ana Tujo with a song, Sacar la Voz. Now we have some news from Bolivia. Bolivian citizens have expressed disinterest in having President Morales to stand for the fourth term. Morales held a referendum for a constitutional amendment for yes or no to the fourth term. And 80% of the votes counted decided that he should not run again. Morales accused the right-wing sector in influencing the results. Evo Morales is an indigenous Aymara and a former local coca producer. He became president of Bolivia in January 2006, and his term will end in 2020. There were celebrations in various Bolivian cities, but the Bolivian government says that they're still waiting for the rural votes to finally make that decision. Now, we have another report from Mexico. There was 49 people killed in a hellish prison riot. A prison riot between rival gangs in the northern city of Monterrey has resulted in at least 49 dead and 12 more injured. Nuevo León Governor Jaime Rodriguez states that the riot started Wednesday around 11:30 p.m. during a fight between two rival gang leaders known as El Credo and C-27. Prisoners reportedly set fire to storage rooms during the riot, but it was not clear whether that was the principal cause of death. It was not clear if there were any prison guards amongst the dead. The Mexican police have reportedly gained control of the Topo Chico State Prison, and authorities say that they have secured the surrounding area. This penitentiary is home to rival Zetas and Gulf Cartel members, but the Sinaloa boss Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, according to authorities, and also no inmates escaped during riots. Dozens of family members of the inmates have gathered outside Topo Chico to demand more information, causing them to clash with riot police who are trying to keep the prison gates closed. This is the most recent incident at a prison, but not the first. Last year, a former Zeta cartel member was stabbed to death. The riot is reminiscent of the 2012 fight between the rival gangs at a Nuevo León jail known as Apodaca, where more than 40 people were killed. Now we come with a different song for you. It's called Para Bailar by Bajo Fondo with Julieta Venegas. Bajo Fondo is a group of musicians from Uruguay and Argentina trying to create a contemporary tango that appeals to many generations. This style is also known as electro tango. Now, I picked the song specifically because it features a Mexican pop artist that's creating some very interesting music in Mexico, and she's singing with this band from Argentina and Uruguay, and they're making this transnational connection between the Southern Cone and Mexico. Enjoy the song. The song is called Para Bailar.
Turns out that was the instrumental version of Para Bailar, but if you want to hear the full version with the lyrics, feel free to YouTube, Google, Spotify it. Anyway, moving on, we have a story from Mexico involving Pope Francis. championing indigenous people during his trip, but avoiding criticizing the government. During Pope Francis's trip, he stopped in the capital of Mexico's Michoacan state, Morelia, a major drug trafficking hub, to meet with young people. This trip has been unique in the fact that the Pope has spoken out about the mistreatment of the indigenous people and the connection that these people have with the Vatican. The Pope's message during his visit to Mexico has fallen in line with his work on behalf of the marginalized communities and the environment in not only Mexico, but the whole world. The New York Times, however, has taken note of the fact that Pope Francis has avoided antagonizing the administration of Presidente Enrique Peña Nieto. The Pope visited the largely indigenous southern border state of Chiapas on Tuesday, which is considered, according to the BBC, the least Roman Catholic state in Mexico. He celebrated Mass in three Mayan languages and asked for forgiveness for the systematic and organized exclusion of indigenous peoples throughout history. During his visit to Chiapas, Pope Francis prayed before the tomb of Bishop Samuel Ruiz, who led the state's San Cristobal Diocese for about 40 years. Ruiz was beloved by Chiapas's churchgoers, but controversial among Mexico's Catholic leadership for supporting the incorporation of indigenous traditions into church rituals. Ruiz also backed the ordination of married indigenous deacons, a policy struck down by the Vatican after his death in 2011. Francis vindicated many of Ruiz's positions. In a decree, he gave his approval for the Aztec language of Nahuatl to be used in Mass. His inclusion of three Mayan languages during his own service signaled that these could be used as well, according to the Vatican press office. Several married indigenous deacons also participated in Monday's Mass. And I think this goes to show a lot about the Pope and his kind of renovation of the Vatican, his very liberal for a Pope stance that he's having.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I saw the Pope's entrance into Mexico. He landed in the Ciudad of Mexico. He was greeted by Presidente Peña Nieto, and Presidente Peña Nieto kind of followed him throughout his trip to Mexico. So it was a very interesting thing to see. The Pope has not been to Mexico, and there was definitely a lot to talk about. We continue to our next story.
First openly gay judge. Puerto Rico's Governor Alejandro Garcia Padilla announced that Judge Maite Oronos Rodriguez will be nominated as the head of Puerto Rico's Supreme Court. If approved by the Puerto Rican Senate, she will be the first openly LGBT chief justice in the United States. Judge Oronos stated, "I accept this nomination with the energy and force of the new generation." Attorney Omar Gonzalez Magan, an attorney for a LGBT rights group known as LABDA, L-A-B-D-A, stated, "This is a significant step forward towards achieving a judiciary that reflects the growing diversity of our country." Next up, we have a song, Aurelio, by Aurelio, known as Landini, upcoming artist from the Pacific coast of Honduras. He blends West African sounds with Caribbean sounds to tell the story of the Garifuna people. He speaks in the language of the Garifuna to tell the stories of the Afro-Latinos. In a historic move, Mexico declared that it will finally recognize the 1.38 million Afro-Mexicanos. The census has continuously ignored them ever since the Mexican Revolution of 1910, but it did not promote their idea of mestizaje. After a lot of fighting from Afro-American activists, Afro-Mexicans will be recognized in the census.
So I think this really connects well with the story of these Afro-Latinos in Honduras and, you know, Afro-Latinos in Mexico, Afro-Latinos all over Latin America, and how they're finally getting heard and they're getting their rights. So the song is called Landini. It is not in Spanish. It is in the Garifuna language, but it's a beautiful song, and we hope that you enjoy it.
Mutu arabo oh maniga na uya landine oh
negra mucho arabo, casa me bella. Disi wachare, kaba me sangualuba, kame gailu wanyaga, casa me bella. Disi wachare, kaba me sangualuba, kame gailu wanyaga. Maniga na uyala. Mutu arabo, oh, oh, oh. Maniga na uyalandine, oh, oh, oh. Anyagira mutu arabo.
Welcome back to Florida Caribe. Now, we have some more news for you from Cuba. Cubans welcome the news of a visit from President Barack Obama in March. He will travel to Cuba on March 21st in order to proceed with the normalization of relations between the United States and Cuba. Obama, who will be traveling with the First Lady Michelle Obama, will be the first sitting president in 90 years to visit Cuba. There are plans for them to meet with President Raul Castro, as well as dissidents and civil society groups, but not Fidel Castro. This is a major phase of the normalization process that follows Obama's and Raul Castro's decision in December of 2014 that they would resume diplomatic relations. The announcement of the president's visit to Cuba comes 2 days after the U.S. and Cuban officials signed an agreement restoring commercial flights between the two countries. Obama even tweeted, quote, "Next month, I will travel to Cuba to advance our progress and efforts that can improve the lives of the Cuban people." The reception in Cuba has been mainly positive, especially in Havana, where the people have high hopes that this visit will accelerate economic and social change there. Since the initial thawing of relations in 2014, tourism has grown rapidly, and the new Wi-Fi hotspots throughout the island have brought internet access to tens of thousands of people. Although there are signs of growth for many Cubans who have not been able to take advantage of the private sector boom in tourism and are still living in state salary, the pace of transformation is too slow. The Cuban officials are still calling for an end to the U.S. embargo that has crippled the economy for more than 50 years, and which remains under the control of the Republican-led U.S. Congress. Cuba also demands the return of Guantanamo Bay naval base, although it remains unclear whether this issue will be included in the March discussions.
President Maduro of Venezuela devalues currency and hikes petrol prices for the first time in decades in an attempt to prop up the economy. The reasoning behind this was to shield the country's oil-dependent economy from collapse. President Nicolas Maduro announced that the pump price of premium gasoline would jump from just under 0.1 bolivars per liter to 6 bolivars, which is equivalent to 1.1 $1.5 US to 95 cents. That is a 60-fold increase from its current level. Maduro claims that this is a necessary action for which I take responsibility. Quote, the time has come to establish a system that guarantees access to hydrocarbons at a fair price, but that also guarantees the funding of investment in producing that gasoline. Venezuela has the biggest known oil reserves in the world and has been practically giving gasoline away in recent years, but has also suffered from plunging oil prices since mid-2014. This move risks sparking protests in a country with an already dire economic crisis where citizens are struggling with soaring inflation and shortages of basic goods such as cooking oil and toilet paper. A petrol price increase in 1989, which came at a time of economic crisis driven by low oil prices, spurred popular outrage that erupted in days of rioting that killed hundreds.
Now, we present you with a song from a band called Pirulu en la Tribu from San Juan, Puerto Rico. They mix New Yorican salsa, Afro-Cuban son, and Puerto Rican bomba to create a perfect symbiosis of different Caribbean musical sounds that span generations. The song is called Loco Pero Feliz, which translates into crazy but happy. You know, I had the great pleasure of seeing this band live when I was studying abroad at University of Puerto Rico in San Juan, and they're an amazing band with an amazing sound. I hope you enjoy it. So while the song is playing, we're going to do some public announcement. The Viva Cal Latino Jazz comes and celebrate jazz and Latin music with Frankie Piñero and the Viva Cal Sextet, featuring an all-star cast lineup playing the music of Carl Tajer, Sheo Feliciano, Ruben Blades, and Tito Puentes. Come and dance the night away when salsa meets jazz. This concert happens on Saturday, March 5th at 8 p.m. at the Fargo Community Media and Arts Center. Tickets are $12 in advance and $15 on the day of the show. Information and tickets are available at WSLR.org.
Also, we have a no-nonsense nutrition health class. Eve Plu's host of No Nonsense Nutrition on WSLR is bringing back her popular health class to Fogartyville. No Nonsense Nutrition Health Class with Eve Plu's will be on Tuesday, March 8, 2016 at Fogartyville Community Media and Arts Center, 525 Kumquat Court in Sarasota at 6:30 p.m. The March 8th class title is My Belly, My Friend, focusing on improving digestion treating burp and bloat, constipation, and diarrhea. Tickets are $7. More information is available at WSLR.org. Thank you very much, everyone.
So now we have an interview with Ryan Catalani and Pamela Marco, who are the co-founders of a nonprofit organization known as Mobility, Movilidad, and are going to talk to us about one of their projects called Proyecto Carito. Proyecto Carito focuses on the story of undergraduates and janitors that have been evolving, that have began evolving identities as writers and have dreams for more inclusive and global 21st century education in a translingual class at Emerson College.
Welcome to the show, Ryan and Tamara. How are you guys?
Hi.
Good. How are you?
So we'll start off with a very basic question. What is Proyecto Carito?
So Proyecto Carito is a collective, and as you mentioned, it's workers, undergraduate students, graduate students, administrators, and professors at Emerson College in Boston, and we are all writers. And what we're trying to do is identify where we have borders inside our own institution regarding access to 21st century inclusive education. So that means everything from classes to library access to issues regarding documentation and status within the institution, so what kind of job you do. And we believe that since we're all in the same educational institution, we should have access to all the same resources. And how can we do that, even with our respective job differences? Say one cleans the bathroom primarily and the other one is teaching in a classroom. And so that's what we do. And we come around a table. We've been together for almost 5 years now. And we discuss where our borders and blockages are and where our dreams are. And then we figure out how to gain access with each other. And we do so by developing relationships first with each other and then with the rest of the campus.
Well, that's really interesting. I love when you mention it doesn't matter what, you know, what work we're doing. Someone is teaching in a classroom, someone's cleaning the bathroom, you know, they still have the right to the equal amount of educational opportunities. That's very important. And I wanted to ask, what prompted this type of program to be started? What was the spark for this?
So one of the ways that this started was about 5 years ago, the members of the administration here met with the facility staff, maintenance worker staff, and asked them, if you could have one thing right now to make your quality of life better at work at Emerson College, what would it be? What would you want? And they all asked for English class. So they wanted an English language learning class. And so then they called me, or one of the administrators called me and said, well, we see that you speak Spanish and you teach English. Could you maybe consider doing this class for a semester? And I knew right away that there is no way that in 1 hour a week people are going to learn English. But I did know that what a privilege to be able to get to know members of the maintenance worker staff and to work with people who are experts at our institution in immigration and resilience and building a new life. And also they're fundamental to the quality of our education here in the sense that they care for the very infrastructure within which we live and work. So I jumped on it. And then we met together, and I said, do you want me as your teacher? I don't really think we can learn English in 1 hour a week, but we can identify other dreams that you have and ways in which English is important to those, and also just language in general and writing and Spanish. And so that's what we did. And to my surprise, to all of our surprise, I think, we're still together 5 years later, and now we're like a familia. We're a family. We eat together. We have parties together. We know about each other's children. When the abuelito or the grandmother dies, we are caring for each other. When there's a blizzard, we're texting each other, are you okay? Which is interesting because as a professor, I'm home, and I have a snow day, and I know they're out shoveling the snow, so I'm worried about them, so I'm writing to make sure they're okay. So, Ryan, do you want to say anything?
Yeah, so, you know, we So we come together every week, once a week, and, you know, when someone new comes to the class, we first, you know, introduce ourselves and say why we're here. And, you know, what's interesting about that is if you come to it, you'll see that what everyone says why they come is that it's the best and most important part of their week, that this 1 hour that we spend together is, you know, something so different from what they experience at Emerson. And that's true for all the participants in the class, that it's, you know, sort of an oasis. Not that it should be, you know, we think that more places should be like this at Emerson and at other educational institutions. But for now, you know, it's a very special community that we've created.
And what type of importance do you think a program like this has? I mean, you already kind of spoke on that, of what it can achieve and what it can do for a community, but what do you think it has, what type of importance it has on the development of a richer, more culturally diverse communities, not only in Emerson, but how do you think this could be applied to other communities? Do you think it's a transferable idea? What do you think about that, about the idea of moving this around? Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a two-part question, I think, and really important. It's actually the core of our mission, why we're still together as a collective meeting once a week, because we could just stay as a familia, right, and be friends, and that in itself would be meaningful. But so we met on Wednesday last week when we knew we were coming to talk on your show, and we wanted them to be here, the people who work, the workers, but they couldn't be here at this time because they're working. Mm-hmm. But we actually interviewed them and asked them what they would say. So we sent you some of those sound bites.
Yeah, we have a clip we're going to play.
Maybe we'll hear them later. But, but one of the things that what they say when because I used to feel like, are we really doing anything? We're not unionizing. We're not protesting in the way that a protest generally looks like. We are in a conference room for 1 hour a week singing and writing. And it's very meaningful for us, but what are we really doing? How are we changing the campus? At first, that's what I thought, in the first year or two, when we were just building relationships. And one of the things they said was, you know, if we could change anything about our education, or about our experience at an educational facility, we would change three things. One, we would want to learn, we want everyone to learn more about context of why people immigrate, and thus why we have immigrated. Two, to be more united among Latinas and Latinos. So for example, if a Latino or Latin American worker and a student encounter each other in an elevator, they should say buenos dias, say good morning, acknowledge each other, so that the workers aren't fantasmas, ghosts. And the third thing they said, and this was so important to them and still is, they said, please say good morning to us. Please acknowledge that, you know, we exist. And so when they talk about with other people, and we do talk at conferences and other places, we have publications, we've made documentary videos, which now circulate in classrooms throughout Emerson, but also nationwide, K through 20 schools, by the way, so kindergarten through university and college level. But what they say is that being seen at their institution where they've been working for 10 years, 26 years, 30 years, is one of the most important changes for them. And it means a lot. It's dignity. The other thing that we have accomplished is that the immigrant workers are now teachers. Not formally. They don't get credit for it, and they don't get paid for it, which I would really like to see them being compensated for it. But they invited undergraduates into our once-a-week class. And the undergraduates come in, and you can see it. They transform. Many times they're shaken to the core. They cry because they realize that person that they've been seeing in their dorm room or dorm, you know, cleaning the toilet every week or every day, is now sitting there teaching them something and listening to them or maybe just caring for them. And they see them. And so then they have to face that, the beauty of it, but also the contradiction of, wait a minute, why is it that some people are at this institution cleaning toilets and I'm here getting a diploma? Why? And so they're facing something they haven't really thought of before. And then the last thing I would say that we've accomplished are, at least at Emerson College, are some very concrete changes. So human resources here now is translating all of their documents into Spanish. When they hold an event, they have translators. They have put members of the maintenance worker staff on committees. So when they have meetings to make changes about all kinds of things, like policies and infrastructure, the maintenance worker staff is now represented instead of just faculty and students. They have library cards. They have access to the computer. And they've been an integral part of a committee at which Emerson College officially accepts people regardless of their documentation. So we have students who apply here, are recruited, and can even receive some funding regardless of their documentation status. So the workers weigh in on that too. And then in terms of, is this idea replicable? Is it a model? It seems like other people think so, because we've been getting phone calls from throughout Boston and across the United States, and also in other countries too, interestingly enough. Colombia is really interested in what we do, Mexico, Brazil. They find us online or we present at a conference. So what we've begun doing is working in consultation with different institutions and schools and some workplaces. And we meet with the people who clean the building. They usually are immigrants. And often they're from Latin America, but sometimes they're from all over the world. And we start with the workers, and we go from there, and we ask, if you could make your workplace more inclusive right now, what would it be? And then we start working on that, and we identify people who are interested and who care about these issues inside institutions. And we work with elders and youth, and because everyone has different kinds of power at the same institution. And that's how we begin to work with them to create change. And we do that through just sitting around the table and talking. We do writing projects together. We do storytelling, meals. And it's a very slow, painstaking process because it's about trust and it's about risk. The people whose stories have the most to teach us risk the most in telling us, and they often benefit the least. So we have to work building trust with each other, and it has to be authentic, because if it's not, everything falls apart in 5 seconds.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting what you said about it simply starts by sitting around a conference table and just talking and getting to know each other and trust, and I feel like that's something that's really missing in the world in general, just understanding the person that's sitting across from you who may have come from a very different circumstance, and just understanding them is like the first step.
And the first step could also be just saying hi to work in our environments and creating a communication and discourse about, you know, identity and our experiences. It's a really great project. So can you tell us a little bit about the mobilidad and where does Proyecto Carito fit into it?
Sure. So Mobilidad is a nonprofit that Tam and I and another director, Jose Sampaio, started last year. And it sort of grew out of the work that we've been doing together for the last 4 years. So Proyecto Carito is one of our three main initiatives that we have. And they're all about this idea that Tam was talking about bringing people to the table who don't often come together, and choreographing conversations with diverse audiences about stories that are not often told. So the other projects that we have, one is a documentary archive in Medellin, Colombia, where we work with women and families who are forced to flee their homes, usually in rural areas, due to violence or poverty, and rebuilt their homes in the city of Medellin. And they've been doing that for the last 50 years. And so this archive is a historical record of how the city of Medellin was really built by the people who really built them with their own hands. And so we do that every summer. We work with more storytellers to create more documentaries. And then the other project that we have is that we work with young emerging Colombian artists to help them travel with their art, cross borders with their art and their stories. So we help them come to the U.S. to do exhibits of their work and also talk with audiences about their work, which is often about the 21st century, some of our most pressing sustainability and human rights issues. And they talk about those very global issues through a very local perspective. that really makes it powerful for audiences across the country that see their work and hear them talk about it.
So they work on water rights, women's rights, youth culture, hip-hop, art, different things that are being produced. And oftentimes it's not just about humanitarian and environmental crises, it's about solutions to it. And it's often young people and women, but not always. And we work with people of any age and from any neighborhood and any educational background. And what we do is we work with them to figure out what it is that they want to say, who do they want to say it to, why. And then we work with them to do all the kinds of multimedia writing necessary for the storyteller and the story to cross borders together. That's the hardest part, especially coming from a place like Colombia, you know, getting a travel visa and so forth. So we choreograph all of that kind of transnational communication with them personally, online. We prepare them to go to the U.S. Embassy, all kinds of things like that, to ask for their visa. Then we choreograph conversations here in the United States. So our last tour, for example, with 9 young emerging artists from the Universidad Nacional de Colombia in Medellin, which is a university there, public university, we choreograph conversations with them so they can speak with audiences in 5 different cities, in Hawaii, in Los Angeles, so in Honolulu, Los Angeles, Boston, Durham, and Medellin in Colombia. And in each of those places, with each of those audiences, it's a different way of presenting information. It's also, we ask the audiences to do some work too. So we expect it to be a little bit challenging for the audiences, not to challenge them on purpose, but just that they're coming to the table to have a real conversation. It's a little bit different than just coming to a museum and observing something beautiful, which is also important. I think that has its place. But what we do is a little bit different. We treat the hour that we have together, or the 5 hours, or whatever it is, with our audiences as sacred moments that make consciousness, social change, and relationship building possible. And then what we try to do with Movilidad is we help the storyteller craft their story in a way, like make a documentary, maybe it's a photo essay, they give a speech. We also help them work with the media, all kinds of things. And then we back away. So Ryan and I and Jota, the directors of the nonprofit, we back away and then let the people who need to come together and have conversations to stop pollution in a well or talk about ways that people can have access to education possible. And we back away, and then the 2 people or the 10 people or the 100 people who need to come together at the table keep coming together and can get done what they want to get done.
Now that you mentioned your other projects and the impact that they have on the people you visit and the communities, just a little bit more about what type of reception and impact do you think the caravans, and also including these new other projects, have made on the communities that you have visited? What type of impact do you think you've made with other people who are, you know, don't know about you, but then you show up and you talk to them and you express this? What do you think goes through their mind?
Well, that's a really good question, and that's something I obsess about this, right? Because I want to make sure that what we're doing is it matters to people in ways that are meaningful to them. And so we were at University of California, Irvine, a couple months ago, and I don't know if you remember this, but there was a big achievement in all of the University of California system of unionization of maintenance workers. And UC Irvine was a place of one of the deepest contentions of all the UC system, just because many of the workers had been working under duress. They didn't have very much, if any, vacation time and so forth. So they were working in conditions that were very, very difficult and had been doing so for more than 20 years. Many of them raised children, for example, without health insurance ever, things like that. And so we went to UC Irvine at the invitation of a faculty member who wanted to begin a writing project, found us online, and invited us to come. So we flew out to California from Boston and met with them. And we met with about 6 mostly women who were maintenance workers. And they had done already great achievements. They'd organized, they'd become unionized, they had different pay, they had vacation, really big things, and also gotten a lot of media attention. And many of them were already grandmothers by then, and they were, you know, they could have just said, we're done. You know, we've achieved our thing, we're done. We showed them our video, which you can find on our website, mobilidad.org, and we showed them that same video of the maintenance workers here at Emerson talking about what we do, presenting at a National Writing Studies conference, talking with undergraduates, professors, and administrators. And the women were transfixed because they said, you know, we've unionized, we've done all these things, but we're still ghosts on campus. It didn't change very much our daily interactions with people in terms of the way that we experience our daily life at work. We need that to change. That's what we have to do next. And the only way that that can happen is if we come together face to face and we know each other. And so that's what they wanted to do. And then the other element of that is that because Proyecto Carrito for us is actually a car. That Carrito, as you know, means little car. It also means my darling, beloved car because of the Ito there, which is the diminutive in Spanish. And so we actually publish our work on a van, roof to rim. Our stories, they're giant pictures of us. And we drive, when we go places to present, we drive it, and we're in it. And then we pile out of it. We're in a parking lot. And so people see our stories on the side of the van or the back of the van or the trunk of the van or whatever. Then they see us come out, and there are pictures of us on the van. Then we come out of the van. We're standing next to the van. So we have all these conversations with people in parking lots, at toll booths, outside of restaurants, in addition to the more formal conference presentations that we give. And then finally, this summer, we're going to do a caravan, and Ryan can talk about that.
Yeah, so, I mean, basically, so we want to make more Proyecto Carritos with other institutions or other groups that are interested in this work, making our education system more inclusive and global and humane. And they should be immigrant-led efforts also. And so we're going to drive this summer in July from Boston to the San Diego-Tijuana border with other cars, other groups that are going to make cars or vans or other vehicles, wrap them with their stories and their dreams and practices for a more inclusive education system. And we'll drive together through a very carefully chosen route across the country and make some strategic stops with audiences that we've developed, that we've prepared to talk with us. And then we'll end on the West Coast and, you know, sort of all come together. And so the trip will take probably about 2 weeks. And so, you know, groups that are interested can still contact us on the website and talk to us about how they can be part of the caravan this summer.
And the website will be, what's the website name for people who want to know?
The website, so for the caravan, you can just go to proyectocarrito.org.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Ryan and Tamara, for talking to us this morning. We have last week, Ryan called me to let me know that they were in class on Wednesday, and if I could send a question over to get some recordings of the actual students in the class, the people who participate in the class, their actual answers. And so the question I sent was, what would you do to change the world? So now we're going to play a clip of some of those answers. Thank you so much, Ryan and Tamara.
Thank you so much. Muchísimas gracias.
And personalmente,
thank you.
Creo que
thank you.
Para nosotros como
thank you. Gracias.
Bye.
Estados Unidos. Ciao. Que diariamente nos relacionamos con personas de diferentes nacionalidades y culturas, comenzaría por tratar de comprender cada una de esas culturas y tomar todo lo bueno de ellas, dejando atrás lo negativo y tratar de adaptarlo a lo nuestro. Y así podríamos comenzar a entendernos mejor y empezaríamos un verdadero compañerismo entre todas las personas, tratando de ayudarnos los unos con los otros, y poco a poco creo que empezaríamos a cambiar el mundo.
Wow.
Mire, yo puse, no ahorita, Brian, porque
cometí muchos muchos errores.
No change, no change.
No, no, no. Sí. No, aquí no hay vergüenza. Everybody, right? Aquí no hay.
Hay vergüenza en mi tiempo.
No tenemos tiempo para vergüenza. Go, go, go.
Primer lugar, yo puse primer lugar para cambiar el mundo. Tenemos que cambiar, como dijo doña Mari, personalmente, porque es cambiar nosotros personal para que cambie el mundo. Cortar con las guerras, eliminar las discriminaciones por nacionalidad, color, sexualidad, no haber discriminación por ninguna razón. Buscar a Dios, cuidar el planeta Tierra, cuidar la naturaleza, velar por los necesitados, ser generosos con el corazón y el tiempo, no dar con expectativas.
Uh-huh.
A recibir. Ajá.
¿Está bien? No, nosotros escribimos las tres.
Tocada.
Sí.
Okay. Nosotros pensamos que necesitamos creer que cada cultura es valiosa y tienen un conocimiento para compartir con el mundo. Necesitamos igualdad y respeto por los derechos humanos. Por ejemplo, educación, vivienda, comida para todos. Aceptar a cada quien como es y cuidar el medio ambiente.
Can I ask one question?
Carrito. Peruanos, hawaianos, de Guatemala, salvadoreños, colombianos, San Diego,
californianos,
de todos. Ah, y faltaban los de Indonesia,
Filipinas,
Puerto Rico,
Filipinos.
Los filipinos. Eso es Proyecto Carrito.
¿Y qué hacemos?
Disfrutar, no. disfrutar las culturas.
¿Y por qué es importante tener el momento que tenemos cada semana entre estudiantes, trabajadores y docentes? Y de vez en cuando mi niña de 8 años.
Pues yo pienso que si no viene uno a la clase, como que no pasa la semana. Como que es algo que uno necesita estar aquí, es un tiempo que esperamos todos desde el lunes.
¿Por qué?
Nos sentimos bien, nos sentimos... son muchas las palabras que se podrían usar en ese... para explicar el momento este, pero pienso yo que es un lugar donde uno se siente aceptado y comparte uno con las demás personas.
¿Y cómo se siente acá de que afuera, por ejemplo, cuando está trabajando en el elevador cerca de...?
Pues la diferencia es que afuera no, como que no somos aceptados, y aquí en la clase pues todos somos iguales, todos aprendemos y todos enseñamos.
So welcome back to Florida Caribe. Those were some of the workers who were talking about the things that they want to change through this project. Paula, we can translate a little bit for them. What did they say?
Mainly they were talking about what really needs to change is the way people perceive them. Like they said in the interview, just say good morning to the people who
communication.
Work in your building, to the people who clean your building, to the people who do things that would not make your workplace the same. Just... they're people. So that was the interview with Proyecto Carrito. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I'm Paola Baez.
And I'm Jarena Jerji.
That was the Florida Caribe Show on WSLR 96.5 LPFM Sarasota, WBPV 100.1 LPFM Bradenton. Thank you, everyone. Have a great week. See you next week. The next 2 weeks, actually. Ciao.
Ciao, ciao.
quick shout out to our amazing sound engineer, John.